Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, world. It's me, Dennis. Today, I get the pleasure of talking with Dr. Nikolaus Wasmoen. How close did I come, Nick?
That was good.
Nikolaus. All right, anyway, I'm going to keep working on it. Anyway, I'm so grateful to talk with you. I'm so grateful to talk with you today because I love the written word. I love the spoken word. There's something about language that just fires me up, even though I haven't delved deeply into it as you have. But I'd like to know, if you wouldn't mind giving me and anyone who's listening a little bit of a biographical idea. When were you and where were you when you fell in love with literature?
Well, I guess really I was actually a physics major in college and I stopped going to classes. I was just reading novels and poems. I was failing out of my math and science classes because I was reading too many books. And then it occurred to me I could just do that. I could just read books professionally.
How cool. So who were the writers that were that impelled you in that way?
The first one really I think is probably Shakespeare, which sounds a little hackneyed to say. But I was reading, and this is kind of part of my later trajectory. I was reading Cyrus Hoy's edition of Hamlet, and there was all this extra stuff in the back of the book. All these kind of related texts and commentaries and annotations. And suddenly it just opened up. It occurred to me that, you know, this isn't actually a play about something. Instead, it's this kind of creative universe, but also something really grounded in like a historical moment. So from there, and in the other book at the same time, for years, I haven't really kept this up, but for years I used to always read Hamlet and Moby Dick every year.
Mm-hmm.
Melville, too, he would switch into pentameter. But you read it, and it's in the form of a novel. And once I started to hear that sound, hearing actually what Ahab sounds like, Captain Ahab, it occurred to me there was a lot more going on there, and I just became fascinated. And luckily, too, with Melville, there's all this other extraneous kind of detail. You know, he spends a whole chapter just talking about varieties of whales in this kind of pseudo-scientific, outlandish way.
Yeah. How cool. From what I understand, help me to understand if I'm understanding this correctly. When Shakespeare was writing during that time for the people who came, the groundlings and all the rest, that they would have understood it. The references, the cultural references and the puns and the inside jokes would have made more sense to them than it does to us.
Yeah, well, it's interesting to think about Shakespeare. When I look back on it now, I see it through a kind of media history lens. And a lot of that has to do, I took a seminar with a scholar named Lucas Ehrn, Lucas Ehrn, I might be pronouncing that wrong. And his argument is essentially that if you actually look closely, well, one of his arguments, if you look closely at the actual textual evidence of these Shakespeare plays, you become aware that this is kind of the moment when people started to write actually for an audience of readers. Because this is the early age of print, and especially the early age of print becoming widely disseminated. So even though it it's usually the narrative that you think of Shakespeare's plays as being mediated kind of poorly through their printed texts.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of what Shakespeare is doing is you know, very hyper-literary and super referential on a level that doesn't really make sense if you're just trying to, you know, please the crowd in a live performance.
I see.
That really opens up the text to modern readers, I think, you know, people like ourselves, to actually being participants and being more closely related to what the author was doing, even if we also maybe want to do different things with the text than people in 17th century England did.
Exactly. I mean, one of the things that always amazes me, I do a comedy routine of three guys coming home from the Sermon on the Mount and having three totally different experiences of exactly, they were right together when they heard that particular speech, that particular presentation, and that all the work, but they had three totally different experiences. And so we bring our full experience into anytime we read a piece or experience a piece. Don't we, Nicholas?
Yeah. You know, the conversation is just starting once you've like experienced a work, right?
Yeah.
Hopefully we can all kind of make it our own.
Yeah.
One of the things I've been working on recently is this idea that I get from an American poet in the 20th century that I study extensively, Marianne Moore,
mm-hmm.
This idea of kind of intellectual possession. The idea being there that, you know, a work of art is made and remade in its viewing. So the taking possession of something can happen in a lot of different ways for multiple people. And it's a different way of imagining the world, really. You know, that we're not trying to own or master a work of art. Instead, we're trying to make it our own with the full understanding that other people are also doing the same thing. And
God,
in
that
action,
so God, that's wonderful. But that gives me a whole different take on it. So therefore, because in the traditional way, the way I would think of it is, okay, well, I'm in class and there is a right answer to this, and so therefore we're all going to that, rather than how it's experience, how it impresses upon me and impacts and affects me. Do I have that do I have an understanding of what you're saying?
Yeah. Now, this comes up in the classroom for me a lot. I think students often want knowledge and they want skills. and that makes sense. That's why you go to school. But, you know, the difference between knowledge and skill is going to be collapsing, I think, the closer you get to a healthy understanding of something like art that is kind of illimitable and isn't really any one person's possession. So there's never really an authority on any significant piece of art to my mind. Instead, there's just people who give us better or more effective tools or more effective ways of experiencing it, from which then we need to go on and make our own knowledge. No one's going to be able to tell you that you're wrong as long as you're, you know, at least well-informed and doing something in an interesting way.
Well, listen, I need a
couple of...
No. But I need help with some definitions just so that I can understand what we're talking about. Now, we're talking about modernism, right? As one of the areas that you study.
Yeah, that's where I spend most of my time.
Okay.
So by modernism,
define that for me in a
modernism.
Yeah.
It can mean a lot of things. So, you know, often people will say early modernism, by which they mean people like Shakespeare or, you know, maybe even, you know, contemporaries.
Sure.
There's also a kind of confusing interaction between the terms modernism and romanticism. Because there's this, you know, outpouring of psychological disinquisitiveness and inwardness that starts to appear in literature in English, let's say in England around the time of Shakespeare. And obviously people who study earlier literature spend a lot of time arguing that, this really happened before that. You didn't notice. After that, there's a long history and there's generations of people. And I think every generation has to, by its nature, consider itself modern. Mm-hmm. So when people say modernist, what they really mean, usually in literary circles or artistic circles, is a kind of historical period that's strongly associated with kind of late stage capitalism. So the creation of like mass print changes things. So it was quite hard to get published in 1610. It's not nearly as hard to get published in 1910 because there's thousands more outlets. There's just an infinite more number of pages being printed and distributed in various ways. The other thing that happens is print becomes cheap in the early 20th century, late 19th century. So suddenly people are no longer paying a lot for books or magazines or printed items. You know, even through most of the 19th century, if you owned a book, you really thought of it as a possession. It was like a physical possession. And in the kind of 1880s, 1890s, suddenly you have just massive amounts of paper being printed and distributed to people with words on them in a lot of different ways. And people stop thinking of books as kind of physical objects and instead start to think more of things like text, like content. And in that moment, you also have a lot of other kind of social changes happening. So there's a lot of different ways to look at modernism. I tend to think of it usually in kind of media history lenses. Some people would also talk about this, you know, in more social terms. So the displacement of people into different kinds of environments. So the rise of cities and the rise of transport. So people moving around different places, increased immigration and emigration. All of these things are always kind of undermining the idea of some idea of modernism as like a historical happening. There's not a moment that we can point to. There's not a real crystal clear definition we can ever have. Instead, the most lasting and I think most robust approaches to the idea of modernism are always about an idea of people becoming self-aware as modern, right? So you have a lot of writers who are purposefully writing not to reach back into the past and say, I did as well as Aristotle, or I did as well as Shakespeare. But instead saying, we need something new. We have different circumstances. We have a different environment. And the art that should be produced from this should be new. Make it new is what Ezra Pound said. And that I think is still probably the most succinct description of modernism. This idea is that we have a different experience, we have a different situation, and we're trying to make our art reflect that and be generated from that, rather than, you know, what most 19th century literature if you read it, tends to have a kind of antique feel, and it's reaching mm-hmm. towards the past, is looking towards past models. It's not embracing things like the thumping sound of a printing press or the kind of whir of gears.
So when I hear the term postmodern, how do I fit that into this matrix we're talking about?
Well, I've never really understood the need for postmodernism, because I've never really believed in modernism as something that coherent, that you could come right after it. To me, modernism and postmodernism don't have as strong of a distinction as a lot of critics build up. And I think the reason they want to have an argument for postmodernism is because they're also feeling that both their awareness and their situations have changed, right? So if I keep saying it's modernism, I don't want to make that sound like, oh, I'm going to make some modernist art as if it's 1920.
Got it.
Comes from a lot of places. And some of that also comes from a more socio-political critique, because this embrace of modern life also means an embrace of a lot of the negative aspects of that life, right? So mm-hmm. when we mm-hmm. think of literature, at least in the English-speaking world, we tend to exclude a lot, or even most of the art and writing that's happening at any given mm-hmm. time. Even within our own, say, geopolitical sphere, we only have a fraction of the material that was actually created in any given year from, say, 1909, 1922, 1934. What we have in our libraries and what we study, and especially what actually gets any attention, is such an infinitesimal slice of the actual creative output of those times. And I think that understanding that there's a much larger world and there's people other than, say, the 50 superheroes that have been kind of anointed by critics and scholars.
Sure.
That, and a lot of those people not coming from the kind of usual channels, maybe people writing in other places and other kinds of conditions, or not even really being published, but perhaps, you know, working in a different kind of literary or communication environment. And I think, to me, postmodernism is responding to that awareness that we're missing a lot in modernism, and also that people took whatever modernism was, and they also took a lot of other different things and created very different kinds of art, very different kinds of ways of thinking and looking at the world.
Wow. I want your version. That really impresses me. That resonates deeply within me as to what you're saying, Nicholas. Thank you. I want to ask you about Marianne Moore. How did she come into your awareness, and what was it that you helped me to understand who she was and why you have spent so much of your time and energy and career with this woman?
it's hard to really explain.
Good. That's a good question. Hooray.
Maybe if I pick back up on the way I was talking earlier, right? That.
Yeah.
If you end up really going down the rabbit hole of, let's say, literary investigation, you're always going to have guiding lights, right? So for me,
yeah.
The full story really resolves, I think, to, on some level, you know, pretty intense interactions with a small number of really, really amazing mentors that I've been able to mm-hmm. work with, and then also really strong and lasting interactions with One advisor of mine used to say kind of they're stable, right? So you have kind of a certain number of horses, and you know, they you might have very different relationships with all of them. Not all of them you can ride. Some you maybe try and feed an apple and not get bitten. But you know, you always have I think this is true of most literary scholars. You've got a kind of small number of really important works and artists who who kind of take over. You know, you don't necessarily go out and search out these things. It's just if you read widely, sometimes you hit on something that you just kind of keep coming back to, and that seems to exceed either your expectations or perhaps, you know, your present abilities. And I think the exciting thing is, you know, actually that feeling of, oh, I'm actually talking, or I'm reading, you know, a real master here. I can see how much better this is than what it would be in normal hands. And I want to know why.
Exactly.
And how did you do that? How did you formulate something in such a way that I can read it 1,000 times and still have a kind of fresh excitement or an uncertainty or maybe sometimes a kind of doubt, you know? So with Marianne Moore, I think a lot of it has to do with her kind of masterful ability to say things very clearly, but in a way that does not resolve itself at all. So some of her poems have this kind of tension between clarity. She often questioned or liked to kind of play with the idea that she wasn't really a poet, that she was a writer. And she would bring in all kinds of different types of language, all different types of talk into the fabric of her poems, while I think kind of winking at us that this is still very much a poem. It still has a very discernible kind of formal pattern.
Yeah.
But she had an almost next level ability to take her formal patterns and rearrange them while still having the actual content of the poem remain intact. So one of the most famous examples of this would be her poem Poetry, which over the course of her career, she first publishes it pretty early. I think when she's in there, I want to say 20s, 30s. And, you know, she lived much longer than that. So over the course of the next 40 years, she kept republishing her poems in various outlets. And every time she would revise them, and this poem Poetry at the end becomes this kind of denunciation of poetry, right? Saying that like, oh, I too dislike, it's almost a different kind of experience, because every time, once you start to really delve into Marianne Moore, you realize every time she sits down to write, she's not just writing something new, she's also rewriting what she's already done. And it's this kind of relentless pursuit of clarity, of conciseness, of expression. It speaks to a kind of discipline of mind that I think is pretty unique, and that I haven't really found in other poets. It's also hard, though, sometimes to follow, because usually when we sit down to read a work of literature, we kind of want something from it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like we want, oh, I took away from that like things aren't as bad as I thought they were. Like, oh, I should be hopeful, or, you know. There is a purpose to everything, something like that. We want some kind of emotional or intellectual payoff. And with Moore, I think she's very aware of that. and she's not afraid to talk about things that are important to her and other people, but they never resolve. You never walk away from a Marianne Moore poem thinking, oh, well, I just gained some easy kind of points. Like, I know a little bit more about the nature of, like, men or women or society or capitalism or something like that. Instead, you just have this kind of lingering thirst, right? This desire, but it's transformed. It's made better by seeing someone with that kind of agility of mind operate on it, who is also capable of making things sound just beautiful.
Oh, wow. Were you alive in 72?
No.
All right. So you would not have had the chance to meet her. Are there conversations with her? Are there audio? Are there ways for you to meet her in other ways than through her poetry?
Yeah. So especially later in life, she became pretty famous, and she was kind of on the lecture circuit. So I think pensound.com or .org. If you go there, mm-hmm. you can hear some of her recorded lectures, which are a lot of fun. You know, she would be sitting down, and especially once we're talking about like the 50s or later, when she'd already won like every major award that there was to win as a poet, and had been lauded by anyone who mattered. You know, she would sit down with a huge throng of undergrads, and this is in the 50s, kind of the post-World War II era, where really the beginning of the modern English department starts, where you have people just coming back and coming into the university in greater numbers, but also still with a little bit more of a kind of classic liberal arts mindset, where, you know, even the top most obscure technical engineering students would go to poetry lectures. So you'd have these thronging crowds of undergrads and faculty, and she would get up, and at that point she had kind of a little bit of a shtick, where she would do this kind of plain-spoken, humble, but incredibly incisive and funny rendition of herself. And I think you know, a lot of that has to do with her trying to maybe rewrite a little bit of history, which is usually delivered in similar circumstances by, you know, people like aldermen or university provosts or things like that, right? Instead, you know, she would take the opportunity to sit up and stand and just kind of lay out what she was thinking and what she'd been writing. So her voice is to me very familiar. She spent most of her life on the East Coast, and first Pennsylvania and Carlisle, and then later in New York City and Brooklyn, Manhattan, Brooklyn. But she always had this kind of Midwestern plain spokenness and a kind of wry humor that I think
God,
you, you know,
wonderful.
If you actually hear it out loud, it helps. Infuse the poems a little bit with some of their intonation.
All right. Well, let me ask you a question here, Nikolaus. I'm a new, primarily your first class, you get a chance to people like me who are ignorant of Marianne Moore, even though I was alive at that time. I had not until I interacted with you. This is the first time in my consciousness that she came across it. But all right, I'm in your class. How do you introduce? What is the first thing you do to introduce an entire class to someone that they never heard of, but was so much bigger and so much more important than the current media would have let us know she was?
Well, you just have to, it just goes back. And this goes back to that same moment, kind of post-World War II, you just do close reading to start. Not that that's the end of what you're going to do. Maybe
no.
you want to do some other
stuff. So that's what you do?
But true close reading, which, you know, one of, when I was undergrad, one of my mentors would say close reading is like actually putting your nose in the crease of the book, right? Like your nose should be touching the page if you're close reading. You're inspecting every detail. So, you know, we might just read a few lines and that could take an easily an entire class. And
not
so, especially with Mort, she's coming from kind of a moment and a scene in which concision and efficiency become real values. So if you think of a lot of Victorian literature, it's very effuse. Like, I don't know if you've ever read like a Walter Pater novel, but that could be summarized in probably, what, 50, 60 words? And I don't know how many thousands he uses. Right? It's this long, flowing, kind of exploratory and recursive and oftentimes redundant type of writing.
Mm-hmm.
So especially Moore's early writing, it doesn't have that. She cuts it down, she slices it up, and every word, every turn of phrase is a product of this kind of chiseling down from some larger, more kind of prosaic sentiment. You know, she often runs the title of her poems right into the body of the poem so that the title doesn't actually, it's not really a title. It's just the first two words or first three words or whatever of the poem. And it's like the fish wade through black jade.
Wow.
That's the first three lines or is it the first two lines plus the title? So, you know, that's something to think about. And why do we expect titles of poems? And why do we expect poems to have kind of like subject matter? Like, why do we expect poems to be about something? What if a poem is actually something more like an observation, or to use one of Moore's phrases, or something more like just words doing something? And we'll have to figure out what they do. I don't know, what are they doing to us? What were they doing when they were written? What were they doing to other kinds of readers? What can we do with them?
Wow. That certainly opens my mind, and it really gives me a chance to be interactive with poetry. Just in the time that we've been on now, and I'm taking you a little bit over past the half hour, unless you have a hard stop, to please tell me. But what you have done is that you have taken me from looking at poetry on a page to actually, to me, stepping into the poem, stepping into it as an interactive experience, as opposed to it just being separated. You have completely changed my perspective to where I'm going to sit inside of it and look at it from the inside rather than from the outside, just in this 30 minutes.
Yeah, one of the things I like to do in the classroom is actually talk up a book, you know? I like to introduce something as like one of the greatest works of art of all time. And then I like to take that book and just destroy it in front of my students, rip it up. You know, obviously I'm teaching like a cheap edition or something for like a used reprint. Not one of my like truly cherished books, but actually tear it up and just destroy it and hand them the actual physical pages and say like, well, why don't we take turns and read? And always it creates this real uncomfortable moment. Like, oh my goodness. are you actually destroying that? Are we destroying it with you? But there's nothing to destroy there as long as you're doing something with it, right? You're not going to have exhausted it through any kind of simple operation of just burning it or ripping it apart.
Yeah.
Especially for works in the print era, right? We're not talking about like original manuscripts, which I also spend a lot of time trying to preserve and reproduce. So, you know, that I think that moment tells us a lot about the way people interact with literature. I think we are used to hearing, you know, the book, you know, look it up in the book,
yeah.
or, you know, what does the book say? And the book probably doesn't really say anything. We can read it and we can say something out of it, but the book itself is just inert unless we give it the kind of love and attention and participation that it requires.
Nikolaus, thank you. Thank you for the time today, and thank you for giving me this small window into your world that I have peered in that has given me an entirely new perspective. And I appreciate your time today, and I look forward to perhaps getting another opportunity to be able to delve deeper into, and or not deeper, I would want newer, because I have a feeling that
yeah,
depth is not depth is not as important as the fresh, the present, and understanding what I can do in the present.
And it's a lot, right? It's always a lot.
It is, and what a perfect time. All right, take care, and thank you so much for coming on the program, Nikolaus, and I look forward to talking with you next time.
Take care.